I don't see anybody who belongs to me. All right. So tomorrow by 11:59 p.m., your papers must be dropped in the drop box. Where's Kerensky? This is like where it was, right, Dave? Talked about the Kerensky. The Kornilov affair. No?
No.
Yeah. Oh, this is where we left off? Okay. So I guess we're here. All right. So. Wait, no, I remember. I told you guys the incident of like the chaos when you're in the dorms and all the rest. I remember talking about that. Do we have a different point? Okay, when I have like 12 of you who were here last class and no one can tell me where we left off, hopefully you can appreciate the concern that I'm feeling in the moment. Because we literally are having the Bueller incident and also the level of grades that we've been receiving in the class. So if you're not taking notes, that starts making me wonder, how are we getting the grades that we've been receiving? Nothing. Wow. Were you taking notes last class? Or were you watching TikTok? All right, do you know where we left off? Because all these people who always have their laptops open can't help me. I thought I finished the Russian Revolution. Thought I did.
I don't think you did.
Did I talk about the Tsar getting shot?
Yeah, you did.
Lenin coming to power, ending the war, Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Does that any of that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. Assume that I finished because I can remember talking about it. Oh, we'll back off this previous, and we'll take a picture. Get the notes beforehand. Not that they aren't online with the outlines, and you can easily do that. No, we good. It'll be interesting to see how many people get perfect multiple choice again. Definitely interesting. All right. So, settlement of World War One. Oh, papers first. Papers. Papers are due 11:59 p.m. Make sure before you drop it in the Dropbox, you check proflamanic.com. Make sure you follow all the directions. The assignment is based on following directions. And if you can't follow directions, you won't get a good grade. But if you can follow directions, you'll get a good grade. As far as concerns over, oh my God, I got to do the Chicago style and I've never done that before. Or, oh my God, I got to use footnotes. I've never done that before. Look, in life, you got to try new things. I understand that most of you were taught when you were in high school and probably up to this point, you were probably taught what, academically speaking, is kind of like the dumbed down version of citations, the MLA. I get it. None of you have probably done this before. But if you intend on going to graduate school, you're going to see Chicago. So the purpose of this is to have you try. If you're not 100% perfect, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. Again, you do your footnotes wrong, you're going to lose 5 points. You know, nothing huge. The goal is to have you try. Am I going to sit there and hyper scrutinize every last little thing? No, I'm not. It's about trying. So if you're close, you'll be fine. The only time you will suffer serious consequences, if you don't put footnotes in, or if you use MLA, you know, you don't follow directions. But so long as you give it a go, it will be okay. No big deal. The purpose is to help students who maybe didn't do well on the exams get a good grade, because most people at your level should be able to follow directions. At least I would hope so at this point in your lives. So it's nothing to be scared about. In fact, I told you at the beginning of the semester, if you recall, the average age, a grade rather, year after year, is about a B. You know, I grade them kind. I'm not one of the English professors who might be a grammar Nazi and sits there with the red pen. Don't do that. I just want you to do your best. That's what it's all about. So if you put your best effort in and you follow directions, you should receive a good grade. That's 20% of your final average. Now, I will have them done, hopefully, well in advance of when you take the final. That's my goal. Because as I said, what I will put in there is your approximate average, where you are now, and what you need to keep your grade, or what you need to go up a little better. But obviously, if I do that after you take your final, it's meaningless. Your final is the 9th, Thursday. Don't have to be here because it's online. The last day in person is Tuesday the 7th. Have to be here because it's an in-person class. All right? So we have to, today, we have 3 class sessions left. Not that much to do. Any particular questions on the paper? Because I'm not going to see you before it's due tomorrow night, 11:59 p.m. And by the way, if you drop it in at 12:00, it's technically late. And the late penalty will begin accruing. Like it's 5 days for the first day. Sorry, I can't talk. I haven't gotten enough sleep. Today's going to be awful. I have a long night, too. 5 points off for the first day, 10 points off for the second day. I think it goes to 20. I don't know. I know it does escalate. So just make sure you get it done. It's not like you haven't had all semester to do it. And it's not like you had opportunities to get extra credit for getting it in early. And a couple of people did. So make sure it's done. And make sure you use good sources. Don't be using no Wikipedia on me. Okay? Because you will drop it in, and the system, Turnitin, will scan it. They will look for plagiarization. That will all be analyzed. So just make sure it's your own work. That's all I can say.
I saw, like, you said there were newspapers and magazines, but, like, could we use, like, Google Scholar?
I don't even know what Google Scholar is.
Use, like, it's, like, scholarly, like, it goes to the website, but then it'll have, like, a PDF. Of like,
oh, so it will pull up like a journal report?
Journal.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So report.
Books, like, I can't see anything because I only get like 50 pages of previews.
You got to find probably an older source.
Yeah.
But sometimes even the previews, you can find something useful.
I have a couple books where like the previews give me enough information.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's what I mean.
Like a couple others to fill
them. Well, I mean, you're only doing a 5 to 7 page paper, so you don't know like you need to use a whole 200 page book. But yeah, if you can get little snippets, that's the goal.
Okay.
Because that's the easiest. And if you can get access to journals, yeah, absolutely. You report it as a journal. Yeah. But Wikipedia? No. Encyclopedias? No. At the very least, I want a secondary source. Something that has citations within it.
Oh, never mind. I was just going to say, like, our website article is fine.
Like what?
I don't know. It's like overview articles with citations in them.
If there are citations in there, then yeah, that potentially could be it. But what type of, you know, is it a blog? Is it like Joe Blow's website?
Let's say like I don't know, like just some like history website.
Like history.com? Historychannel.com?
Yeah, something like that.
No.
History.com, though?
No, that's History Channel. That's TV. Are there citations in there?
What is history?
Yeah, okay. Well, it's like the same as Wikipedia. It's just a blurb. Something that looks like it could be peer-reviewed and verified. Because if you just use Joe Blow's of the historychannel.com, all those are words. And are they actual facts? Or are the people just making them up? An organization would be fine, like a legitimate organization. Like, I don't know, if you were doing something that was health related, you know, like who? You know, the World Health Organization, something like that. But again, if it comes down to, oh, we got a whole bunch of guys and we like going and drinking beer and we got some pickup trucks and we're going to make a blog. Yeah, no, that's not going to work. We have to have some type of academic standard. Any other questions? You should know this all by now, though. I'm sure they tried drill. I mean, you probably didn't pay attention, but I'm sure your teachers back when you were in elementary school said, good sources, good sources, good sources. All right. Settlement of World War I. Let's finish this, then we can go on to the other stuff, and then we will call it a semester. World War I would come to an end in the year following the collapse of the Russian Empire. The end of the war came in November 1918. And there was a series of events. Basically, long story short, the German military realized they had enough men and enough bullets and bombs to fight into 1919. But after 1919, they were spent. So the military made a gamble in which they would protect Germany by protecting the institutions that Bismarck built Germany on. So we're going to protect the monarch. The Kaiser was convinced to abdicate. He left Germany and he was given sanctuary in the Netherlands, a neutral country. So he was untouchable. They then created a parliamentary government, a republic, because that's what Wilson said he would negotiate with. But the plan was that when the republic failed, the German people would hate the republic and want the monarch back. So it was a game, a political game. 2 days after the Kaiser stepped down and a new prime minister was appointed, the war came to an end. At the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month, in the fourth year of the war, Armistice Day. What does armistice mean?
Ceasefire.
Ceasefire, very good. Okay, I asked for 5 minutes. Seriously. I'm literally teaching a class on World War I. You think I can remember where I am in two classes? So I got to the 14 points. So I did this, I did that.
Yeah.
Talked about the terms. They have to give up basically everything. Their guns, their bombs. Brest-Litovsk, all the rest. Germany's not defeated. I just alluded to that point. Why did they agree? Because of this guy. We did the 14 points. We know the most important one. Created what?
That alliance thing, I think.
Yeah, the alliance thing, League of Nations. Very good. All right, so there we go. The alliance, we didn't get to hear, though, right?
No.
All right. That's all you had to tell me. I really didn't remember. It wasn't a trick. See, what happens is when you get older, you got so much bandwidth that's being used with everything. Can't remember little details. All right, so President of the United States comes up with this grandiose plan. By the way, he was a minister's son. He was what today we would call a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And he was a progressive. So he believed that his virtues were superior to everyone else's. So the virtues of the 14 points, that there would be a peace without victory, that there would be self-determination, those were Wilson preaching, and he basically was telling the world what he expected the post-World War world war world to look like? Well, the problem is the President of the United States in 1918 is not even close to the power and influence of the modern presidency. Today, if we had a capable president who said something, the world would listen. Of course, our current one, nobody cares. But the power of the office is there. So if someone other than the current occupant gets elected in November, then again, the president will have the ability to use the bully pulpit, and he will have the ability to wave his finger, and you know, all the free countries will be like, okay, President of the United States. But back then, no. The United States didn't come in the war until 1917. England had been fighting since the beginning. France had not only been fighting, the whole Western Front was in their country. Thousands upon thousands of acres were devastated. Towns depopulated. Billions and billions and billions of dollars of destruction. Belgium occupied. Well, now you have the newcomer that comes in. The United States was not a world power. The United States just barely got great power status. And when Wilson started waving his fingers, the leaders of the Allies basically said, you lose. No. Because they all wanted the spoils. They wanted stuff. The stuff that you get when you win wars. My phone keeps going off. My daughter is at home. Okay. One of the Allied leaders, Italy. Italy, if you recall, was a member of the Triple Alliance, but when the war broke out, they declared neutrality. But in 1915, Italy came in on the side of the Entente. England and France. Because Italy was promised land in the Balkans. So guess what the Italian Prime Minister wanted when the war was over? He wanted what he was promised. He wanted those lands in the Balkans. And, ironically, when he arrived in Paris, the peace conference, that's what he expected. Territorial promises. But ironically, as they started working out the peace treaties, Orlando learned that he would not get what he was promised. So he actually left. He took his ball and went home. He got on a train and went back to Italy. So of the three great leaders, now we're down to just two. With Wilson. British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. Lloyd George's attitude was best summed up in a single quote. When he got on a boat to sail across the English Channel to go to Paris, reporters asked him, Mr. Prime Minister, what are your intentions at the peace conference? And his reply was straightforward. It is my intention to squeeze the German lemon until the pips are squeaked. Do you ever make lemonade by hand or orange juice? And you sit there with the delicious half a fruit and you got the little juicer and you squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. I'm not talking about the automated ones. The automated ones are not fun. But you do the old-fashioned handheld. Just keep going, going, going until there's nothing left. That was Lloyd George's intention. He wanted to strip Germany of its colonies, its overseas possessions, its bank accounts. He wanted to take it all. And French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau. Well, he was the elder of the four leaders. He was the oldest. And he could not stand Wilson. He found him obnoxious. And he famously said to a French reporter, who put the story in an American newspaper in English that, and I quote, "Mr. Wilson bores me with his 14 points. Why, God Almighty only has 10. He didn't care about this. Oh, the war to end all worlds. Let's make the world safe for democracy. He didn't care about that. His country, billions of dollars of damage, millions of lives lost. You know what he wanted? He wanted restitution. He wanted reparations. And he wants more alliances. He wanted Germany to pay for the damage, continue to pay for the future damage, and he wanted to do Germany what Bismarck did to France. All right, so Orlando's gone. That leaves the big three. In order for the peace settlement to be hammered out, it takes three votes. Well, here's the funny thing. Lloyd George and Clemenceau, they weren't dumb. Nope. They understood how the American political process works better than any of you. Guarantee it. Because one, they knew partisan politics. Democrats versus Republicans. In the 1916 political election, Democrat Woodrow Wilson barely won. Prior to the 2000 election, where Bush only won by about 600 votes, the closest election in U.S. history was the 1916 election. Wilson won by 2,500 votes in California. Like this close. So they knew that he didn't have the mandate of the people. Plus, he got reelected promising to keep America out of the war. But just 2 weeks after he took the inaugural oath for his second term, because it used to be in April, he petitioned Congress for a declaration of war. So he lied to the American people. And the people were angry because America didn't want to get involved in World War I. So in the 1918 midterm elections, the Democrats lost control of Congress. In particular, the Senate. They were working on arranging a peace treaty. In order for America to sign on to it, the president doesn't make treaties. Or rather, strike that. The president can't get the United States into a treaty. In England, in France, the prime ministers can. But thanks to the brilliance of our founding fathers, we have checks and balances in our system. And under our Constitution, it takes a two-thirds vote in the United States Senate to ratify a treaty. And because Wilson lied about keeping us out of the war, in 1918, the Republicans had the majority. And do you think the Republicans were going to give a win to the Democrats? And by the way, Wilson was a noob, a boob, a buffoon. He should have known the political dynamic, but you know he didn't. So when he went to Paris, all he would have had to do is invite Republicans with him to make the peace process a bipartisan measure. But you know what he did? He intentionally excluded any Republicans. He only took Democrats. Because he wanted to be able to say that the Democrats won the war. Now, by the way, we still have the same partisan politics today. And it's so frustrating. Because I hate to break it to any of you. The Democrats are not right. But neither are the Republicans. That's why if you read the words of the Founding Fathers, they always talk about compromise. Give a little to get a little. But we've lost that. And this is a good example. So guess what Lloyd George and Clemenceau was able to do every time Wilson opened his mouth? With these grandiose visions of progressive peace. They said, okay, Mr. President, maybe we're not going to vote for your league because we don't like that idea. And point after point after point, Wilson gave in. So if you compare the other 13 points to what we're going to see in the Treaty of Versailles, nothing's there. All of the stuff that Wilson called for, gone, except for the creation of the League of Nations. And of course, the best part is, the League would have no teeth. The League would be as useless as the United Nations is today. The UN has no power over anybody. Because all it is a bunch of politicians who talk. They have no army. They have no military authority. And the League was the same way. But of course, the best part was, the United States never joined. It was Wilson's baby. And the Republicans in the Senate said, no, we're not on board. We're not going to give up American power. Questions? Go away, guys. Bad animation. All right. So what came out of the peace process? Well, beginning in January 1919, going all the way until 1921, the delegates of the leaders of the Allied nations gathered and they discussed the terms for the losers. What would be produced would be five separate treaties. Five separate treaties. One for Germany, one for Austria, but Hungary was cut off, so there would be another for Hungary, one for Bulgaria, and then one for the Ottoman Empire. Although the funny thing is shortly after the Ottoman Empire was got out of the war and the treaty was made, they had a revolution and Turkey broke away. So they had to go around and make another treaty that dealt with Turkey. Now, of the five treaties, by far the worst was the Treaty of Versailles. This was the treaty between the Allies and Germany. They intentionally signed it on June 28th. Because what had happened 5 years before? Which started with what?
The assassination.
Of?
Archduke Franz Ferdinand,
yep. They intentionally chose that date to kind of go like, the German people. Now, I don't expect you to read all 275 clauses of the Treaty of Versailles, but if you can, if you're curious. But let's just say this. All of the pie in the sky, Protestant progressivism, virtue signaling of Wilson is not present in this document. The whole purpose of it was to punish Germany so much that Germany would be crippled, with the intention of never allowing them to start another war again. No spoilers, but obviously that didn't work out too well. Here's what they did. the map, I don't know if you can see it in the back, Ernest, but the brown, the orange, and the lime green, this was what Germany was before the war. But after the treaty, they sliced off approximately 20% of their real estate. Chopped off, chopped off, chopped off. Most of this land was farmland. So not only are they taking land, they're taking people, but they're also taking food. In this region, we're 10% of Germany's factories. So you're going to take their food, you're going to take their ability to produce things. Because they lost Alsace and Lorraine, there goes 2/3 of their coal and iron deposits, as well as 50% of the lead, the basic tools to have an industrialized economy. All of the stuff that they got from Russia, Brest-Litovsk, gone. All of their colonies, gone. They had colonies in Africa, in the Pacific, and they had spheres of influence in China, gone. All of the money, German money, that was in international banks, gone. All of the German companies that opened up businesses in other countries on earth, gone. The army, which was one of the most important institutions in Prussia society, was reduced to 100,000 man force. That includes officers and enlisted men. Essentially, they once had the most powerful army on earth, and it was reduced to the National Guard. No offense to anyone who have family members that's in the Guard. I respect their service as much as any Marine. But obviously, someone who's in the Special Forces, Navy SEAL, Marines, they're big badasses. Well, Germany once had the big badasses, and they were reduced to guardsmen, weekend warriors. That was significant because of what was going on in Russia. With the collapse of the regime, the Russian Civil War, because Lenin was talking about spreading communism globally. So that would terrify the government and terrify the people. Its navy, gone. Because it lost all of its colonies, no more oil, no more rubber. And as bad as all that was, I got two things that are even worse. This strip right here is called the Rhineland. This was German territory. But for 15 years, this would be occupied by Allied armies. This is the traditional border of Germany. And prior to the war, that's where all its fortifications were. Well, unfortunately, for 15 years, they were not allowed to defend their own country. And they could not put a single military soldier west of the Rhine River. So what I'm saying is their country for 15 years were occupied by foreign armies. And lastly, reparations. Reparations, money, damages. They didn't set a figure in the Treaty of Versailles. The German people were told they would have to pay and pay and pay and pay and pay and pay. So for 2 years, any ounce of gold, anything of value, they had to give to England and France, the United States, in Belgium, etc. It got so bad that by 1921, you could go in with a baby carriage full of paper money and you couldn't buy a loaf of bread. Hyperinflation was triggered. But the Allies would eventually set a number at 34 billion in 1921 money. And Germany would actually pay that off. Germany made the last World War I reparation payment in 2009, I think. I don't remember the year, but it wasn't that long ago. But I do know it was on my birthday. It was October 3rd. So much for peace without Victor. But I'm going to do one more. The final clause of the treaty prior to the section that contains the creation of the League of Nations. It's Article 231. It's the only number that you're going to see on the exam. Article 231. This contains the War Guilt Clause. When the German delegation signed the treaty, because they basically had guns pointed to the head, and they were forced to, basically, not literally, figuratively speaking, they accepted this clause in which Germany was held solely responsible for the First World War. It was their fault. So never mind what the French were doing before the war, or the Austro-Hungarians, or the Russians, or the English, or the Serbs. None of that stuff no longer matters. All of those facts, the truths, that this war was everyone's fault. Nope, 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 nope. Just Germany's fault. This is much worse than you getting blamed for something that your brother or sister did. That's for sure. Questions? Why was it this bad? Well, again, 2-1. In order to get the League of Nations language into the Treaty of Versailles, Lloyd George and Clemenceau kept saying, nah, to anything that Wilson wanted. No diplomacy, no virtue, no morality. Nope, 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 nope. All we want to do is punish the Germans for the war and suck them dry. Because someone had to lose for 4 years of war and millions of deaths. But I got two more things for you. Two more things for you. Do you want to know how this was all about the stuff? Proof number one. Not a single German government or military official was put on trial for war crimes. Not the Kaiser, not Paul von Hindenburg, who was the commander-in-chief of the German army, not Eric Ludendorff, Hindenburg's aide, who took over the political process of Germany. There were no generals. No one was punished. If Germany really was guilty, shouldn't the men in charge be found guilty for that? But not a single one. There would be trials, but only 12. And they all involved submarine commanders. That was it. Submarine commanders who shot down and sunk civilian ships. Plus, yes. No.
He was still around.
Yeah. He ended up going to the Netherlands. He lived to 1941. The Dutch gave him a nice estate. He was out on the North Sea. Again, he lived to 1941. He spent his time writing poetry and painting. And even though he had his withered arm, he also, because he was actually not a war criminal, he would spend whatever free time he could splitting wood, chopping wood, and he gave it to all the poor people that were in the village outside of where his estate was. So he could have been put on trial. In fact, Clemenceau wanted him to, but David Lloyd George and Woodrow Wilson voted that down. David Lloyd George said no because Willie was George V's cousin. And one cousin, Nicky, was already dead. And that's the last thing they wanted to have. And Woodrow Wilson basically said it's probably not a good idea to put leaders of countries on trial because look throughout history. When have they ever put another leader of a country that was involved in a war on trial before? You know, it was unprecedented. Long way to answer your question, but make sense? All right. Point number two. In 1914, the British put a naval blockade in place in which they blocked all shipping going into the North Sea. This included food, medicine, because what the Brits tried doing is strangling the German population. And when the Spanish flu broke out in 1918, plus there was a couple of years of bad harvest, by the end of the war, close to 1 million people in Germany starved to death because of the blockade. Well, the blockade remained in place until Germany signed the treaty. So the moment they signed, they lifted the blockade and they started bringing in foodstuffs. Well, another 600,000 people died in 1919 in Germany. Oh, and by the way, they knew what they were doing. Proof was a book written by John Maynard Keynes. I know they don't have economics here. Or do they? Do they have economics? Do you have to take an econ class?
Yeah.
Micro, macro? Did you learn about Keynesian economics? Yeah, this is the guy who came up with it. Keynesian economics. Keynes. John Maynard Keynes. Well, he was a delegate to the Paris Peace Conference. And he got so disgusted by what Lloyd George and Clemenceau was doing, he actually quit, went back to England, and wrote a book criticizing every single aspect of the treaty. But the biggest thesis was this little point right here. He argued that this treaty was a Carthaginian peace. Any of you ever have any brain fart. Any of you ever have Roman history before? Class where you covered Roman history?
No.
Any of you ever hear of the war leader called Hannibal?
Yeah.
Crossed the Alps with the elephants. He was a Carthaginian general. Rome was growing from a city-state to a Mediterranean power. At the same time, Carthage was vying for domination. So basically, Rome grew into Carthage and vice versa. So they would fight three wars, the Punic Wars. In the first war, they fought to a draw. In the second war, the one with Hannibal, Rome won. Hannibal marched up and down Italy for 15 years, caused lots of destruction. So the Romans decided to invade Carthage. And they laid siege to Carthage and basically choked them, the city, into surrender. Well, after the Second Punic War, Rome put a significant treaty on Carthage that literally involved a requirement that Carthage remain unarmed. The terms basically said, if Carthage ever picks up weapons again for any reason, even in self-defense, Rome will consider that an act of war against the empire. Well, in the 2nd century BC, a neighboring kingdom, Nubia, started invading Carthage because Carthage had no army. And so the Carthaginians, they did try reaching out to Rome and saying, hey, look, we're being attacked. But Rome never responded. So what did they do? They built an army. And they fought back and beat the Nubians. Shortly thereafter, Roman legions arrived. Carthaginian peace is what they did to Carthage. They killed every single military-aged male. And they enslaved every woman, child, and elderly person. Depopulated the city, state. They then set it on fire and burned the whole city to the ground. And then once the smoke cleared, the legions went in and leveled any remaining stone structures. It was said that no two stone stood on another. And then, when they were done, they salted the fields, making it so Carthage was essentially dead in an unlivable place. What Keynes wrote was what they did to Germany was equal to what Rome did to Carthage after the Second Punic War. And at some point, Germany's going to rise again. And the only way to defeat them is to destroy them all. In other words, in 1919, he literally was the first person to say, there's going to be another war. Questions? Because you know the only way to deal with a rabid dog is to shoot him, right? All right. League of Nations. The League of Nations was ASAP on Shaw docs. 2 p.m. at the latest. League of Nations. The League of Nations, as we said, was going to be an international body. And they would draft a covenant, a constitution, on how this world body would operate. The core mission was what Wilson wanted, to maintain peace. But Franklin. Sorry, work. Apologize. If refi 200. HELOC. Okay. The main job was to maintain peace. How? Well, this would be a body in which all of the nations could gather and discuss international crises. The power of this body would rest in three separate branches. The first was not there. Oh well. The first was the assembly. It was called the assembly. All member nations had a right to sit in the assembly. By the way, to join the League of Nations, you had to apply. And the body voted on whether or not to accept you. If memory serves me correctly, I think when it ended, I think about 60% of the nations of the earth were involved. Not us, though. The purpose of the assembly was they were the ones who listened to the issues and they debated the issues and they could vote on the issues. So we're going to have a diplomatic solution that is democratic in nature. Controlling the body was an executive council. Literally called the council. So we had the assembly, and you have the council. The council, by design, would have 5 permanent members and 4 other rotating members. Their job was to set the agenda. So, there's a dispute between Romania and Belgium. Well, we're going to have it on this day. That's it. They set the agenda. And because the League did not have an army, if there was a dispute, it would go before the World Court. That was the third branch. Or actually, technically, it was called the Court of International Justice. Court of International Justice. So, there's a dispute between Belgium and Romania. The body hears it. They decide we're going to vote on the measure. Oh, but there's a potential violation of international law. So it goes before the court. And then the court will make a judgment. The intent was to avoid war through diplomacy. Because essentially that's what all the members pledged to do. They would respect other nations. They wouldn't try to invade. They wouldn't try to start wars. They would respect peace. And pledge to submit disputes to the League. So I don't like you, you don't like me, we're not going to duke it out. No, let's go bring it before the League. And let's get the situation adjudicated. But here's the problem. Ultimately, the League would fail. And it would fail for a whole bunch of reasons. The first is, the way the war ended, there were winners and losers. And the losers were mad. And the winners gloated. Nations were still greedy. They still wanted more, more, more. But now, only some nations can get it. And last but not least, all they could use is words. That's it. Words. They had no military. They had no teeth. They could not actually do anything to any nation that didn't listen to them. So at the end of the day, all they could sit back and say is, stop. And ultimately, that's how we ended up with World War II. They couldn't stop Japan, they couldn't stop Italy, and they could not stop Hitler. And by the way, when this was signed, everyone in the world knew it. My favorite quote about this comes from a socialist newspaper in Germany called Vorwärts, which is the People's Voice. When the details of this treaty were published, the editorial staff included this line down at the bottom. We must never forget that this treaty is only a scrap of paper. Treaties based on violence can keep their validity only so long as force exists. Do not lose hope. The resurrection day comes. They knew it was only a matter of time before they could get the revenge. But the issue was, who was going to give it to them? Questions?
Unfortunately, no more pictures. Just words.
Only words. That's ironic. Alright, as we know, because we covered it, the world in the decades before World War I involved 7 great powers competing, gobbling up every last ounce of open space. But as a result of World War I, Russia gone. Germany crippled. The Austro-Hungarian Empire gone. So three of the seven were knocked out. The United States, they pulled away and went back into isolationism. That pretty much left England, France, and Japan. So those nations would come to dominate the immediate post-war world. The problem, though, was the nature of the war itself. World War I was an event unlike any human civilization had ever seen. It escalated to levels that were unfathomable. The tools of war were the stuff of science fiction. Planes flying down and shooting at you in big steel-clad beasts and gas weapons and flamethrowers. Well, prior to the World War, everyone was still kind of holding on to the liberal views of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. They believed that human capacity, brains, that people could talk like adults, that you could use diplomacy to settle solutions. But in the end, democracies failed. And all that was left was violence. So in the chaos of the destruction, the people of almost every single country in Europe started looking for short and simple solutions to their problems. Because taking shortcuts is easy. But what they ended up getting was totalitarianism. Something much worse than monarchy. Totalitarianism, where the state has total control over every aspect of life within that country. Now, ultimately, totalitarianism arose because of the desperation. I pray to God that you never have to experience a world equivalent to what your great-great-grandparents had to live through. Maybe another great in there, because you guys are young. What played out on a world stage? Again, you had 4 years of war where battles were fought on just about every single continent on Earth. And then you had the Spanish flu on top of it all. You had death everywhere. Well, when the war was over, people tried rebuilding, but there was nothing, they didn't have the means to rebuild. So they were looking for anyone who was going to promise them quick, short solutions. And you know what didn't work? Democracy. They didn't want to have discussions. They didn't want to have debates. They didn't want votes. They wanted it done. And so what emerged was a bunch of groups in all of the countries, even in England, even in France. And what did they promise? Solutions. Short and sweet solutions. Nothing complicated. And they all were manipulated via socialist messaging, where they promised to give you stuff if you were loyal to them. Lenin, when he seized power with the Bolshevists, he promised peace and land. Hitler, on his campaigns, promised bread and soil. You support me, I'll give you something. I'll take care of you. I'll give you the basic needs. Joe Biden, vote for me and I'll wipe away college debt. All socialists promise these little things. But what they don't tell you is who's going to pay. Now, of all of the totalitarian movements that emerged, the most significant, the most lasting on world history would be two: fascism and Stalinism. And both were two sides of the same coin. Fascism, Stalinism are socialistic in nature. There's nothing right-wing about them. That's literally the click. I didn't know that one was coming up. I'm glad I put that in there. This is where I thought we were going.
And both are the same. Both are not about trying to explain the way things actually work. That takes time. That takes effort. That takes studying. That takes mentally debating, analyzing. No. These movements, the leaders would give fiery speeches, which would whip the crowds up into a frenzy. And everything was cloaked in romanticism. Meaning stories. Whether it's, you know, glorifying ancient folklore, or trying to bring back appreciation of ancient myths or rituals or the glories of the ancient past. They were all the same. Promises that if we have the willpower, if we make sacrifices, if we are strong, we can achieve anything. But here's the thing. Have you ever watched a movie? Do you go to the movies now, like in movie theaters? I know they're like bombing. All the movies are bombing and they're all on the verge of going bankrupt. But I don't know if you guys still go to movies. But maybe we'll recall back before the COVIDs when people actually used to go to the movies. Because movies used to be good before the COVIDs. Well, you ever go and see a quote-unquote comedy that if you were to watch it at home, you would just kind of sit there and watch it like this? This is dumb. But if you were in an audience and suddenly someone on one corner of things started laughing, you'd find yourself laughing. Or you hear a song and you're by yourself and you're like, eh. But then you're at a party with a bunch of your friends and everyone's like, this is awesome! We as creatures, we're social creatures. We have a tendency to fall into groupthink. If someone tells us something's good, we have a natural tendency to want to get along and say, okay. Well, imagine being in a crowd where there's lights and special effects, and you have the speaker making promises of a better tomorrow, and all we need to do is just work hard together and we can achieve it. Nobody in the crowd is going to take a step back and be like, is this possible? Can it be done?
No one's going to ask, well, what are the consequences? How do we get it? No, people are just going to be like, yeah!
Because that's what we are. So these movements were based on removing doubt, removing questioning, because they exploited the groupthink. And they were fierce. Fierce, fierce, fierce. Stalin was nothing but a Bolshevist thug who assassinated people. Hitler was a World War I veteran. He managed to survive all 4 years of the war. He earned two Iron Crosses. Benito Mussolini World War I veteran. All of these guys lived through death and destruction. And when they got into politics, they literally brought with them that kill or be killed attitude into their politics. So their goal was not to negotiate with their political rivals or reach compromise. No, their goal was to completely destroy them, to cancel them. All of the movements had private armies. Literally. The Nazis, for example, they had the SA, the stormtroopers, the Sturmabteilung, the brown shirts. If the Nazis heard about the communists having a political rally, the brown shirts literally would go down with clubs, guns, and knives and try to kill as many commies as possible. And by the way, the communists, the Red Guard, they would do the same. Politics was warfare on the streets. Because most of the people involved were veterans who had no jobs. So they joined so they could wear a uniform again, so they could be with the band of brothers. And by destroying your enemy, that means the winner is going to have complete power. And it all involved worshiping the leader. Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini. They were portrayed as godlike figures who had all of the answers. That they cared for you. That if you gave them power, they would take care of you. You would never have any wants or fears. To paraphrase one of the Nazi models, mottos, one leader, one party, one national will. So, you put these people in power, they take total control, and they will save you from a life of misery. Now, where fascism and Stalinism are two sides of the same coin, they are also a little different. The biggest difference is scope. Both are socialist, where the party takes over the apparatus of government and takes over society, top down. But the difference is Stalinism was about destroying all the nations on earth. They wanted a one world government with Moscow at the center of power. Fascism, be it the Italian fascists or the German fascists, had nationalism involved. So they wanted socialism for their people. So fascism, Mussolini's fascism, was socialism for the Italians. Nazism was national socialism, socialism for the Germans. So there was a racial component to it. Whereas Stalinism, now everyone was going to be united. Questions? All right. So, let me see. We got like 5 minutes left. I don't have time to get into Mussolini. Don't have time with what we got left of the semester to talk about Stalin. So what we'll do is we'll see, I'm going to compare and contrast what happened in Italy, and then we'll see what happened in Germany with the rise of Hitler. And that will basically be the final. Okay? So, 11:59 tomorrow, papers due. Make sure before you drop it in the Dropbox, you check proflamanic.com. Make sure you submit the final draft. I think you drop it in and then you go down the bottom and submit. I will start getting to the papers. I'll grade them in order that they came in. Some people have already sent me their papers. I haven't graded them yet. So they're first. So first in line, first in right. But I will work my way through. And before we have a final, I'll get to them all. All right? Good luck getting your papers in. I'll see you all on Tuesday. Your light's on. You're welcome. Didn't want you to actually drain the bath. Yep, thank you.